Jay Ballastrary, arguing on behalf of the defendant, Jessica Nellison, is Michael Diesel. Mr. Ballastrary, why don't you start us off?
Thank you, and please the court. The problem in this case, the problem with the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case
is that it was against the state.
Pardon?
The problem with the decision is that it was against the state.
That was a huge problem.
That's why we're here. Right. All right.
The problem with the rationale of the Court of Appeals decision that was against the state
is
that the Court of Appeals seemed to think erroneously that when a defendant seeks to have the state disclose the identity of an informer, there are two different tests that apply. One test that applies when the defendant has to make the initial showing that would get the defendant to an in-camera review of the testimony of the informer. And that different test applies when there is an in-camera review and the judge is questioning the informer to determine what testimony the informer could give. The fact is that if you look at the statute that deals with the disclosure of identity of an informer.
Say that again. The Court of Appeals erred in two tests?
The Court of Appeals erred in thinking that there were two separate tests.
There's only one test?
There's only one test.
Okay, what's the test?
The test is that the informer has to be able to give testimony that would create a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt by supporting the defense that has been asserted by the defendant. There is a difference between the preliminary showing and the showing at the in-camera review. But it's not with respect to the test as to what has to be shown. The difference is relates to the standard of proof. We fully concede, and we conceded this back in the Outlaw case 25 years ago, that the standard of proof relating to the defendant's initial showing is only a possibility. The standard of proof at the in-camera hearing is, if you want to call this a standard of proof, in fact. The question is whether the informer can, in fact, give the testimony that has been identified by the informer as necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence. That's where the difference comes in. Only in the standard of proof, not in what has to be shown.
Where do you get the test, the ultimate test, at both steps?
Okay.
To get an in-camera view and the step of an in-camera view. And you say the test is the same, that the defendant has to show. You didn't
right.
say that, but that's what it is, right?
Right.
The defendant has to show that the informer can give testimony creating a reasonable doubt about the kid's guilt, his being the defendant.
Right.
And not only reasonable doubt, but by supporting the defense that the defendant
yes.
claims.
Right.
That's the test. Where is that? Show it to me in Outlaw or show
okay,
it to
the,
me in
the
Outlaw.
Test. The test comes in from this court's interpretation, a majority of this court's interpretation in the Outlaw case.
Okay, read it to me from the Outlaw case.
Well, I will read it to you from the Van Monavong case.
How about from the Outlaw? You can't do it from the Outlaw case?
Well, Van Monavong is actually a better statement than you'll find in
Which
the Outlaw.
Which one is earlier? I'm sorry, I don't have read that. Remember, let's see. Outlaw test is 1982.
Yeah. And we've had a couple of cases that have come down since then. Van Monavong is the most recent case.
2003.
Yeah. And what that does is kind of explain a little better than outlaw did.
Let's see it there.
I'm sorry?
Okay. Let me see it there.
Okay. And what Van Monavong says is...
What page are we at?
261 with second, 202 of paragraph 24.
Paragraph 24. Okay.
Right.
Just give me a minute to get there.
And
give
that's
everybody
it.
A minute.
I'm talking about page 11 of my brief, if you want to see where I quote the testimony, or quote the opinion of the court. The informer's testimony must support an asserted defense to the degree that the evidence could create a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt.
I'm sorry.
And then they go
on
reading?
To
say at paragraph
30. Where are you reading?
I'm sorry?
Where are you reading?
I am reading from the first, paragraph at page 11 of my brief.
I know. I want to read it from the outlaw, from the case.
Sorry?
I want to read it from the case.
That is a quote from the case.
Okay. What page are you at, Mr. Bellis?
I'm at page 11 of my brief, and I am quoting paragraph 24 of the Van Monavong case, which is in accord with outlaw and later cites outlaw.
Well, it's paragraph 32, according to your brief, not 24.
No. What I read was from paragraph 24.
Okay,
and then I have another quote.
Okay.
From paragraph 32.
Necessary to the defense, the informer's testimony must support an asserted defense to the degree that evidence would create reasonable doubt.
Right.
Would create or could create? Outlaw, of course, says could.
Good. I'm sorry. I misread that.
I'm prepared to answer that question, if it's a question. I assume it is.
Well, the outlaw says could.
And Van Monavong says could. But if you look, but you have to remember that what these cases are doing is they are construing a statute. And what they say, they use the word could rather than would. I think that's just a technicality. Because if you look at the statute, what the statute says is, and I'm quoting the statute here, page 9 of my brief, there must be a showing by a party that an informer may be able to give testimony necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence. The statute does not say could be necessary. The statute says give testimony necessary, which means that it is necessary. So when you look at the court's comments, you look at court statements in Outlaw and Van Manavong where they use the word could, what they're really doing is they're not being precise. Those statements are not being specific because the statute itself does not use the term could. The statute basically uses the term
is. Necessary, but that's exactly what outlaw is doing. What do we mean by necessary, outlaw says?
Yeah.
Let me tell you, outlaw says in the concurring opinions. Let me tell you what we mean by necessary. And on page...
140 to 142.
Yeah, thank you. I have my
141, 142.
140 and 141.
Which I do not quote in my brief, but I cite in my brief.
On page 140 of the outlaw, it says, I believe an informant's testimony is necessary, because now we're talking about what is necessary to me, if it could have created in the minds of the juror a reasonable doubt regarding a defendant's guilt. It goes on in the next paragraph on that same page. In my opinion, the informer's testimony revealing that he could not positively identify the defendant could have created in the minds of the jurors a reasonable doubt. So the court not only set up on page 140 of Outlaw the definition of what necessary is, and that is it could have created in the minds of the jurors a reasonable doubt. In the very next paragraph, it applies that definition of necessary. So how can you say it's would?
You have to understand the context in which outlaw arose.
Yeah.
This case is a pretrial appeal. This is an appeal from an interlocutory order.
Mm-hmm.
Outlaw was an appeal of right from a trial where there had been a determination of guilt or innocence.
Right.
There had been a determination by a jury. Mm-hmm. So what the court was saying in Outlaw was in reference to the jury's determination. The jury, looking at this testimony, could have determined that it created a reasonable doubt. That's what the could means. Now, we all know that in a jury trial, and this is a pretty basic law, the jury doesn't have to believe any witness. The jury can accept testimony, it can reject testimony. So what the court was saying in Outlaw, I think, by the use of the term could, was that if the jury, and we did have a jury in Outlaw, if the jury had believed the informer, which it could have done, the jury could have believed the informer, if the jury believed the informer, there would have been a reasonable doubt. I don't think you can read Outlaw in a really technical sense to say, well, because they used a word that began with a C instead of a W, that they were trying to create a test that was somehow different from the statute. I don't think they were trying to do that.
There's a lot going on in the discussion in this case and Outlaw. There's a difference between probability and possibility, may and could and would. All of those words have meaning, especially when you have a statute referring to 905.10.3b that says that an informant may be able. Now, that's generally deemed to be possible.
We concede here. Yeah. We conceded back in Outlaw.
Like you said, you not only conceded that it was possible. In fact, the opinion in Outlaw says you conceded that the state conceded that it was the burden was a, quote, light touch indeed, unquote.
Well, I don't think I used those words.
Well, that's the words that the opinion used.
Yeah, but I don't think they were my words.
Well, that's what they said.
But we concede. We concede.
Not just possibility, but a light touch indeed, the opinion
said. Well, that's what the court said. But again, that's not what I would say. That's not the kind of language I would use. But we can see that possibility is a low standard of proof. But that's not the question. The question is not the extent to which the defendant has to show that certain facts exist. The question we're talking about here today is what facts does the defendant have to show?
Maybe that's what we're talking about. I mean, it seems like the big rub, I see this as a Goldilocks case. I think that you want too much. I think that the Court of Appeals wanted too little. And I think there's some place in between. And I think the some places in between is the very holding of Outlaw. You want to add things to Outlaw in the statute. You want to say you have to plead specific allegations.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't say that in the statute.
No, it doesn't.
You want to say that you have to show that it would exonerate, which would exonerate. Factual allegations, page 19 of your brief, which would exonerate her. Well, the statute doesn't say that.
No, it doesn't.
No. So that's why I say, you know, you want to add a little bit. And I think if you just stay, what's wrong with just staying with the concurrence and Outlaw? Or just staying with the language, more importantly. What's wrong with just staying with the language of the statute?
Because the one word that you are focusing on in Outlaw, the could, is not entirely consistent with the statute. And as I said, and I'm not faulting the court for doing that. I'm not necessarily faulting them, because as I said, they were talking about a different situation than we're talking about now. They were not looking at the statute in a vacuum. They were looking at the statute in the context of a criminal trial that had been conducted where evidence was presented and where the jury had made a decision. And what they were saying, again, is that if the jury had chosen to believe this testimony of the informer, if they had chosen to believe that, then there would have been a reasonable doubt. So there could have been a reasonable doubt if the jury had believed the testimony of the informer. And I think that's why they used the word could in outlaw as opposed to would or does or something that's a little more specific. But in answer to your question, your previous question, that I'm trying to add something to the statute, I'm not trying to add anything to the statute that hasn't already been added other places. And
Counsel, I want to redirect you a little bit. Let's go back to Vanna McGon. And I'm looking at what I think is probably paragraph 24, but it doesn't have a paragraph number in mind between 23 and 25. And what I want to read to you, and the word that is most of concern to me in the statute is the word necessary. Years ago, I had a law school professor, Ted Finman, whom I dearly loved, and he talked about how important the word necessary and also how important the word sufficient were in the law, and they might have different meanings in the legal context. Now, as I look at Van Manigong, it is reaffirming, as it says, the concurrence in outlaw, and it talks about necessary, and I quote, necessary in this context that the evidence must support an asserted defense to the degree that the evidence could create a reasonable doubt. How is that statement any different than the majority statement of necessary in outlaw?
Well, this is the majority. I mean, this basically...
All right, then the lead opinion. Sorry about that. The one that people tend to rely on.
Everybody gets confused about that.
How is the concurrence any different from the lead opinion?
Okay. Because the lead opinion in outlaw was much, much broader in terms of what was necessary. The lead opinion suggested that testimony was necessary if it had some bearing.
If it
some
was relevant rather than necessary.
Rather than showing an actual reasonable doubt. If it was just relevant, if it just, you know, had something to do with the question of guilt or innocence, then the defendant was entitled to an in-camera hearing.
Okay. Well, with the definition of necessary that's most recently been set out for us in Van Manigong, With that definition, what kind of statements do you think the defendant should have made in order for the confidential informant to be able to give testimony necessary to the defendant's state of mind? Because that's the defense. I didn't know, right?
Yep, she didn't know. Right.
Okay, so what should they have said? What should they have said to meet that test for necessary?
Okay. Let me just preface that with something I talk about a little later in my brief, and that's the Green case, where this court made clear.
I'm familiar with the business about medical records and so forth. I want to talk about
I don't want to talk about medical records. I just want to talk about one thing that Green says that's relevant to my answer to your question, and that is that the motion seeking the identity of an informer has to be made in good faith. I think that's very important. The defendant can't just come in and...
We're not talking about good faith. I asked you a question about what should he have told you in order that it be necessary.
And my answer to your question is, if the defendant can come in and say in good faith that I did not know there was marijuana in my car, what she would have to allege is that given what the informer told the police, it is highly likely that the informer was one of the people who was riding in the car on the way from Minneapolis to Stevens Point. And if the informer was one of the people who was riding in the car, it is possible that the informer knows, A, that I was not present when the marijuana was put in the car, and B, that nobody told me that the marijuana was present in the car. That's the allegation that would have to be made.
How could she ever, in getting back to your good faith, in good faith, say that the informer knows nobody ever told her there was going to be marijuana in the car? I don't see how she could ever say that in good faith. How would she, how can she say the informer knows what the informer didn't hear or see? I mean, that's what you're,
that's what you're asking. That's exactly
Just let me finish, Counselor, before you answer, okay?
Okay. All right.
How can she say that the informer knows everything that's been told to her? I think what you're asking is impossible for her to say.
And I agree with you. It is impossible because it's impossible under the circumstances of this case. I don't think Nelson can show this because she can't say that the informer would know this. But that's what your question was, what would she have to allege?
And that's what she would have to allege. Right, right.
That's what she would have to allege.
That's a conclusion that the informer could say she didn't know, because he could say she wasn't there when the marijuana was put in the car. She wasn't part of any conversation I heard about the marijuana being in the car. But I don't see how she can allege that the informer knows nobody ever talked to her about it when he was not a part of that conversation.
Well, that's exactly the problem with the showing. That's exactly the problem. That's why she can't show that the informer's testimony is necessary, because she can't show what she needs to show to create a reasonable doubt. Or it would be very difficult for her to make that showing. Now, you know, assuming in good faith, she says, well, we know who these people were. We know the names of three people who were there when the marijuana was loaded in the car. There was a fourth person who may have been there. We don't know for sure. We know the names of all four people who were in the car. Could they testify that while they were riding in the car, none of them heard anyone mention the marijuana? Mr. Green, I didn't hear anybody talk about marijuana. Rico Scott, I didn't hear anybody talk about marijuana. George, I didn't hear anybody talk about marijuana. Miranda Brooks, I didn't hear anybody talk about marijuana. That's the kind of showing that she would
have
to make.
How would she? She doesn't know any of them are the informants.
No, you can do that.
She might guess that one of them might be. Aren't they all defendants in the case?
No, they're not.
Which one is not?
There are two that are not. Rico Scott and Miranda Brooks are not defendants.
Would any of them plead the fifth?
Could they?
Yes, they could.
They could. Mm-hmm. They could. Mm-hmm. But whether they could plead the fifth is not the test.
No,
because this statute does not deal with making evidence or testimony.
All right. I'm going to take you down a different path, Mr. Ballastri. Outlaw, which Justice Heffernan wrote, had two parts to his discussion. One part, and he sets forth the methodology, obviously thinking he's writing for a majority of the court. And he sets forth the methodology in pages, starting in page 122 or thereabouts, and going through 123. His methodology, as I understand this case, was that the defendant had to make a showing. There it is. It's on page 125. The procedure for an in-camera hearing is triggered by, quote, and he quotes the statute, evidence in the case or from other showing by a party that an informer may be able to give testimony necessary to a fair determination of the issue of guilt or innocence, citing 905.10.3b. This portion of the rule doesn't place, I'm reading from Outlaw, a significant burden upon the party seeking disclosure. There need only be a showing that an informer may be able to give testimony necessary to a fair trial. And then he goes on, and then he says, at once it was known there was an informer present, it was appropriate for counsel to assert that the informer's testimony might be necessary for a fair determination of guilt or innocence and ask for disclosure. This is a minimal burden on the defendant. As we understand the position of the Attorney General, he recognized the burden of showing that an informer may be able, which is from the statute, to give testimony to a fair trial is light indeed. The showing need only be one of a possibility that he could supply testimony necessary to a fair determination. Once the showing is made, then you get into a second stage. And Justice Callow, who got the majority on his opinion, and Justice Steinmetz, whose concurring opinion was joined by everybody, so put them all together, they spell majority opinion, never deal with the first step.
That is absolutely correct.
They deal only with the second step.
That is absolutely correct, and that's exactly why we're here today.
That's right. And from my reading of Outlaw, and Heffernan's opinion on Outlaw is never challenged on this, and it is a light, light step. And you are giving it a very heavy step. I don't know who the informant is. I have no idea what the informant is going to testify. I, as representing the defendant. And all of a sudden, and my defense is, hey, I didn't know it was marijuana. I have no idea who the devil these guys are. I have no idea what they're going to say. And you want me to show the court that this unknown person who has unknown evidence will establish and affect the jury on the beyond the reasonable doubt standard that I knew or didn't know. One of the points about not seeing the evidence and not knowing who the informant is, I can't do that. I can't be that specific.
Outlaw did it.
Pardon me?
Outlaw did it.
That's terrific. In any particular case, maybe they did. But as a general rule, you can't say they will. And here, as a general rule, you can't say she would have known how to do that here. In fact, everything that you indicate how she might have done it, the defense is not possible in this case.
Not possible in this case because...
Because what?
She knew that there was marijuana in the car, let's face it.
You say that, but you don't let me have in-camera review. Can I have in-camera review so I can make that determination?
I think we can make that determination from the complaint here.
Pardon?
But we can make the determination from the complaint. I see my red light is on. If I may just...
You got 5 minutes of rebuttal. Go ahead.
I can say it in rebuttal.
Okay, fine.
If the court wants. Yeah, I can do that.
Any other questions?
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Don't forget what you're going to say. Mr. Zell, representing the defendant.
Good afternoon, members of the court, opposing counsel. May it please the court, I am Michael Zell. I'm here representing Jessica Nellison this afternoon. Ms. Nellison, in this case, is seeking an in-camera review because she was pulled over. There was a pound of marijuana in her trunk after she had picked up three individuals in Minneapolis at the request of a friend. She told the police at the time she was stopped that she didn't know anything about the pound of marijuana in the trunk. She repeated that over and over when she was questioned, and she continues to assert that she was not part of any group that had decided to make this trip for the purposes of obtaining a large quantity of marijuana.
Who asked for their jacket that was in the trunk?
That was Miranda Brooks, the front seat passenger. Watch this in the Court of Appeals, obviously, and I think that this is an attempt to change the rules, rules that really don't need to be changed. I think we have everything we need in the statute and in Outlaw that provides the decision that the Court of Appeals made, and I think it's the right decision.
What did you say that you think gives you the right to the in-camera review that focuses on the confidential informants being able to give, quote, necessary testimony about your client's state of mind?
I apologize. I think I misunderstood your question. Is it that what did the motion allege?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
The motion is attached to
what
my...
What did your client say through the motion? I assume that's who you're speaking for.
Correct, yes. The the motion itself, I think it's paragraph 3 or 4, is attached to my response brief, and it indicates that based on the circumstantial factors here, which the Court of Appeals relied on in making its decision, the direction of travel, the location, the presence or the location of the items in the trunk of the vehicle, the informant had a lot of circumstantial information which would make it reasonable for someone to believe that this witness was either transactional as part of this or had a great deal of inside information in some other way, and therefore may know circumstances or facts about the transportation of the marijuana into the vehicle and then into the trunk. So the motion itself indicates that the informant may be able to provide information about Nellison's knowledge, not specifically the contents of her mind, obviously, but the facts which would support her lack of knowledge.
Well, that's your defense. She didn't know, correct?
Correct.
All right. And my concern with what you're telling me is the same that I got after opposing counsel on, is that, sure, he can say, I didn't talk to her about the marijuana. She wasn't present when I heard the marijuana discussed, but there's no way he can say everything she may have heard from everyone. I don't see how it can be necessary to your client's state of mind if he can't put that last piece in there.
In other words, completely tie the loop on her knowledge, that it would be impossible for her to learn about it in any other way.
I think it would depend. I mean, I understand that you'd like his name, so you can ask him, was she present when the marijuana was put in the car? Did you ever talk with her about the marijuana? Was she ever present in a conversation about the marijuana? But to me, that's a very, very limited scope. I mean, when her girlfriend called her up and asked for a road trip, we want to go on a road trip, he doesn't know what they talked about. He may have said, we're going to get some nice weed and we're going to go on a road trip. There's no way that he would be able to talk about that, and that's how her participation in this venture got started. So I guess my concern is I'm not sure some defenses can fit under 905.10 sub 3. When you look at the word necessary, which is what bugs me about all the arguments that are going on.
And I think this is the state's argument, essentially, throughout this appeal. But, there is an assumption here. The state has the burden of proof, obviously, in a criminal case. And there is an assumption here, I think, made by the fact that the marijuana is in Ms. Nellison's vehicle, and she's in the vehicle at the time the marijuana is found in the vehicle. Those are facts that the state can use in this case to support their prosecution. Nellison's defense, lack of knowledge, or any other defense, like lack of identification or things like that, I mean, Mr. Balistrieri is correct in his brief when he says this is proof of a negative. But I think, and my response to that is that to require a defendant to be able to show that there's absolutely no way that she could have learned about this in advance would exclude from these cases cases where there is necessary information because it could lead the jury to a reasonable doubt. If Nellison didn't see it go into the trunk, it's her car, she didn't see it go into the trunk, There was no discussion among the participants in the car, and so she didn't learn about it that way. The state doesn't have any other affirmative proof that she learned about it in some way. Then I think those facts are necessary to her defense, given that the state has the burden of proof, and whether they can meet that burden is the question.
Counsel, I want to continue to focus on the word necessary. And in fact, when I look at the two concurrences, which are the majorities in Outlaw, that's what their concurrences are about. And I'm going to call the concurrences now the majority just for ease. I'm talking about that which is written by Justices Callow and Steinmetz. So they say, here's the statute. What does necessary mean? They have four prongs as I read their opinions, which form the majority. The first is on page 140, and I'm going to go through the four prongs as they define what necessary is and ask if you agree at the end with that's the test. Okay? Necessary, according to Justice Callow, it's necessary if it could, quote, could have created in the minds of the jurors a reasonable doubt regarding a defendant's guilt.
Yes.
On page 141, he also elaborates and says, I would limit the test to evidence being necessary to support the theory of defense. So you've got it. Could have created in the minds of the jurors a reasonable doubt regarding the defendant's guilt, and it has to support the theory of defense. Those are the two things that Callow makes. And Steinmetz then adds a little bit. Number three, Steinmetz says, I would add that in determining whether the testimony of an informant is necessary, the judge should determine whether the testimony and resulting evidence would be merely cumulative. So that's the third one. If it's merely cumulative, it's not necessary. And the fourth one is perhaps subsumed in the third, but he goes on to say in that same paragraph, in addition, whether evidence from an informant is necessary may be determined by whether the same information or evidence is available from any other source or sources. So those are the four prongs of necessary that I see set out by the two concurring opinions which form the majority. Do you agree that those are four prongs of definition for necessary?
I do.
Is there in the concurring opinions any other prong that you would add that how they define the word necessary?
I don't think so, no.
Is there anything else that you want to add to the definition of necessary that the two concurring opinions set forth?
You know, I haven't thought of this issue before. I don't necessarily have a problem with the four prongs as you're outlining them. I think we've all talked about these. I don't have any suggestions at this point, no.
I'm a little confused. Outlaw, in setting forth these prongs, that is in the majority opinion, is dealing with the second stage. When there is an in-camera review, what is the test for ordering the state to reveal the identity of the informant? This case is not at that stage. This case precedes it to decide whether you should give an in-camera view. And ordinarily, in cases involving in-camera review, it's not the final test of are you going to disclose the evidence. It's less than that, because the person asking for in-camera view does not have the records. Therefore, it's hard for them to make an argument that it's going to reveal information because they don't know what it's going to reveal. They want to get to the judge because then the judge can look at these records and say, oh, there's something in here that shows something no one would have ever thought of. And that would be important to the defense, that it would have created reasonable doubt, it would have supported the defense, it's not cumulative or is, etc. So I don't know that you can use the prongs of necessary to at the first step. The first step is a light one.
Well, possibly, and it seems to possibly necessary. I mean, that's what's so difficult about this case, I think, is that there are two steps. And to you know, looking at the balancing of the public policy issues, I mean, certainly those are important in both directions. But, you know, a defendant has a right to present a defense. And so when is information possibly necessary? The rule, the statute itself, the language is quite simple. When the informant may be able to give testimony necessary to a fair determination. And so I don't know that, you know, the outlaw test of necessary provides any modification to that. The fair determination of the defendant's rights at trial is really what's at stake here. And that's why I think in the Roviaro case that that is the federal court equivalence here of outlaw, I think, the case that preceded the Wisconsin statute, which outlines this rule. The federal rule, you know, they have chosen a different route, I think. They have said that no fixed rule is appropriate, and that's because there can be many different situations. We talked about a little while ago whether Nellison's case is one that can ever ask for an informant, things of that nature. Well, you know, federal cases, California courts, they take a slightly different route, and they look at what kind of a witness do we have. Based on that kind of a witness, what are the factors? What's the defense? There are so many myriad factors here that my concern is that the language being proposed here by Mr. Balestrieri and the state is going to significantly reduce the opportunity for defendants to receive this discretionary review by the court in cases where there very well may be information in the possession of the informant that is necessary. And so making the burden too difficult at this first step, the possibility step, is a real concern.
Counselor, you know, I got your motion back out to look at it again, and something that stuck out at me the first time I looked at it, and maybe it's of no import, but each time you talk about her lack of knowledge of a large quantity of controlled substances, which makes me wonder, did she know there was a small quantity of marijuana in the car?
Well,
like what was in her purse? Or?
I think the complaint asserts that the parties were all smoking marijuana on the way to Minnesota.
Yeah.
And so that's
why you said large quantity, to try to focus on what was being transported supposedly for sale with the scales.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
No one was charged with possession, were they, in this case? I know she was charged with a delivery intent. Was anyone charged with? Three were charged with the felony. Were the other two charged?
Well, in the same complaint, two other members of the car, or occupants of the car, were charged. That was Richard Green, the individual who was picked up in Minnesota, mm-hmm. and William George, who was apparently in the car from Stevens Point.
Mm-hmm.
The Miranda Brooks, who was a front seat passenger, may have been charged. I can't tell. I was just reviewing CCAP recently, and there was a charge against her for possession of marijuana on CCAP. I do not know if that was the same offense or not. Rico Scott was never charged, to the best of my knowledge. It seems that he cooperated with the state, and so there's no charges filed against him.
Now, it may be that the informant cannot give information, may not be able to, give information about what everybody said to her at all times, starting with telephone calls or emails or way before this. On the other hand, it doesn't require that there be an absolute information that absolutely shows no guilt. Doesn't require that. It just means you have to have enough in there to shake the jury.
Right, and that's where the words would and could are very important.
And so, and we're still at that first stage of getting to an in-camera view. So, if you had an informant who said it was one of the other people who was in charge of this large quantity, they're all smokers, they're all users, but X is the big Gahana who's going to deal with this. And that as far as the informant knows, and he's familiar with all of them, she's never had any other experience with transporting. And she's a user and a good friend. Now, that doesn't mean she didn't know, but she could have found out elsewhere. But it does tell the jury that someone who is familiar with these transactions and these people, that person is not familiar with her as a seller.
Right. And the concern in this case is that it's her car, it's her vehicle, she's the driver, the drugs are in her trunk. That's the major concern. And that's where the specifics of her defense in this case, the language suggested by the state that she would have to prove in advance of an in-camera hearing specifically delineated facts, it just doesn't make any sense. She can show from the circumstances that this informant has a lot of information, and she can show that she may be able to create a reasonable doubt, or that the informant's testimony could create a reasonable doubt if the informant can say Ms. Nellison never saw the drugs go into the trunk, she never heard any discussion about it, she was never around when other people were showing the product around or whatever it may have happened. But we have no way of knowing whether the informant would say any of these things at this point. It's all a secret to us. No investigation will unravel that information. We don't know if the informant was in Stevens Point or in Minnesota or in the car. We have no idea. So creating a hurdle at this point that would prohibit defendants from even having this in-camera review, I think it violates the statute and the spirit of outlaw. I think the rules that we have in front of us here are really quite straightforward, and the Court of Appeals applied them correctly. And the contrast to that is the Kendrick Lee case, which was decided on the same day and which the state included in its brief, where Mr. Lee was standing next to the crack cocaine in the residence when the police broke in. And he claimed that he was moving his brother's stuff into the basement. But the police officer testified that, well, there was no furniture or moving boxes in the basement. I didn't see any of that. And in that case, the informant could have only provided testimony that someone else had been selling drugs from the front door of the residence. So in Mr. Lee's case, the informant's testimony had absolutely no relationship to Mr. Lee's defense, and whether there was 1, 2, 3, or 16 people selling drugs from the front door of that residence is impossible to know. So Mr. Lee's case is a shining example of when an informant cannot get to that first step because the evidence in the possession of the informer could in no way relate to his defense, could not support a reasonable doubt to the jury.
I was surprised, perhaps naively so, I was surprised when in both of your briefs you suggest that maybe the informant is one of the passengers in the car. And so, you know, there's five people in the car, including the defendant, and at least four more. So if the I suppose if the informant were one of the passengers, for instance, let's say the girlfriend, that informant might have a lot different information than if an informant happened to be
is a person who was in Minnesota who never made the trip, you know, something like that. But, I mean, both of you suggested that. As I started reading the briefs, I had no thought that the informant would be in the car, but both of you suggested that as a possibility.
It's hard to know, obviously. It could be someone standing on the street in Minneapolis when Richard Green was picked up. It could be someone in regular phone contact from Stevens Point. It could be just about anyone, but certainly it could have been one of the passengers of the car. I think the only logical choices here would be either Rico Scott or Miranda Brooks. Miranda.
And if it were she might have a lot of information as to what the defendant knew or was told.
Who knew what, yes.
And why she picked her as the driver.
That's correct, yes.
So why would you need this whole informer process to get either Miranda Brooks or Rico Scott as witnesses?
Well, I don't think we would. The issue is whether, but we don't know who the informant was. If it was someone else who witnessed the transaction, it's certainly possible that Miranda Brooks and Rico Scott could refuse to testify, could assert the Fifth Amendment privileges. And the informant could be some other person who witnessed the transaction in Minneapolis. So, you know, the question is the information necessary? Well, I think it is because we don't know at this point whether we can obtain the information from other places. And there's a perfectly good chance that we can't.
You ask in your brief that this be sent back to the trial court to conduct an in-camera review. Do you think the trial court uses the right standard to decide whether it should conduct an in-camera review?
The trial court really didn't explain the standard it was using. The court said that it simply didn't believe there was enough information presented to differentiate this case from any other informant case. In essence, a slippery slope argument that if I review in camera the informant's testimony in this case, I'll have to review it in every single case that comes before me. And I don't think that's true, but I do think the Court of Appeals opinion here has provided direction, and that some set of rules that are provided by this court or the Court of Appeals would be applied by the Circuit Court.
Well, should this court set forth what the standard is at this first step and send this back to the trial court to decide whether those standards apply here rather than this court order an in-camera review?
I think it should. But
which way? It can do one of two things, if I read your brief right. You can send this back and order an in-camera review. Or you could say, hey, this is your decision. This is the standard. You apply it. You can take testimony. You can hear argument.
I understand what you're saying. I think that the only logical choice is that the court does have the discretion, even given the standard, the rules. There are a set of rules, and the court, I have no doubt, would apply them appropriately.
But do you want us to order an in-camera?
Well, I think the court should conduct an in-camera review. Whether you order that or simply order the court to adhere to the standard, I think is not the most important thing I'm concerned
about.
You're
going to get an in-camera, your view, if he applied the right standard.
I think so, yeah.
What do we do with the due process argument? In reading paragraph 17 of the Court of Appeals opinion, they indicate that they resolve this case on a statutory basis and then don't need to get to your due process argument because it's resolved on statute.
And I think that the due process question is whether the whether the defendant's due process rights under the 14th Amendment are being affected when the information that the informant has is not being reviewed, and so we do not know whether potentially information which could exonerate her is being introduced or not. And I think, it depends, first of all, on how the court resolves the statutory question.
I guess the chief was asking
you about what do you want as relief in this case. Do you want this court, if you would prevail, to order an in-camera or remand for that, or remand for the circuit court to exercise its discretion applying the standard? Or do I ask, given paragraph 17, do we, if we would rule against you, do we remand to the Court of Appeals to address the due process argument that you didn't, that was not addressed? I don't know the answer. That's why I'm asking.
And I don't know either, although I will say that Mr. Balistrieri pointed out earlier that this is an interlocutory appeal, and so there is the opportunity to appeal as of right following the case if it's decided against Ms. Nellison. Whether the due process concern is one that has to be addressed, I guess, largely depends on what happens in the trial court. So I don't know that the court has to address that at this point. The Court of Appeals could address that question, but frankly, my client would probably like the case to proceed at this point and would rather the case were simply remanded and proceeded through the trial court to see what the outcome is.
Without jeopardizing an ultimate review on that basis of due process.
That's right.
So that should be made clear if that's what happens.
Right.
I think you said that the informant theoretically could be in Wisconsin or in the car or in Minnesota. If the informant were someone who wasn't in the car but was from Wisconsin, or was someone not in the car from Minnesota, how would they know what transpired during the time that the defendant was in the car?
Well, there's all these text messages, or, you know, I mean, I'm not really sure what we'll find, but there could be a lot of communication among co-conspirators in the case about what's occurred or what's occurring. I have no idea of knowing what that informant could know, other than that they may have a lot of information about what the parties were doing in terms of making their plan succeed, obtaining marijuana from Minnesota and bringing it to Stevens Point, and how that occurred, where they may have stopped along the way, what other circumstances may have occurred. The Minnesota witness would certainly potentially be a direct witness with observations about when and if marijuana was placed into the trunk, or what discussions occurred between the participants in the car or outside the car during a stop along the way or while they were loading the car. Someone in Stevens Point, I think it's true, the connection is looser, and that may prove that the in-camera review to not be necessary information to Ms. Nellison's defense. But without knowing at this point what communications may have occurred and how that person could have obtained such detailed information about the location of the drugs in the vehicle and the direction of travel and everything like that, we don't know what that information may know about the entire transaction.
You concede, I think, as a factual matter, that the informant might not be able to seal your case.
Absolutely.
It, that it may not be absolutely bring in evidence that showed beyond any doubt that she didn't know. So the only thing you might be able to get is some evidence that would indicate from the informant that he or she has no reason to believe that your client knew. Wasn't in the usual mix, wasn't part of the group, has no knowledge that she was part of another group, although he's familiar with the movement of drugs between Minnesota and Wisconsin, that kind of things, which would cast doubt, but would not seal it beyond a reasonable doubt.
I see my red light is on. Can I answer?
Yes.
I do concede that there are potentially limits to what the informant can provide, and I don't think that there's anything said in Outlaw, Roviaro, any other case that's addressed this, that suggests that in order for it to be necessary for the defense, that it has to absolutely, beyond any shadow of any doubt, tie up the defendant's defense. If it could create a reasonable doubt, which means could support her defense, which provides evidence related to one of the elements of the charged offense, then I think that is sufficient.
You know, I keep coming back to this. That is not necessarily the test for getting to in camera. That is the test for whether the judge orders the informant's identity to be revealed, and that you need probably less if you hold on to outlaw.
I agree. We need a possibility of that.
Right.
Necessary.
Possibility of that, not the end result. Those are the two different tests in outlaw. And the majority opinion in outlaw, which means the two concurrences, joined by all four justices, did not deal with that first issue. It dealt only with the second issue of the test for releasing the identity after an in-camera review.
I agree to some degree. There was some discussion about the first step, only to characterize it as light indeed and as a lower burden than the second step. They did not comprehensively address that question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ballesteri.
What I was going to say at the close of my opening argument was this. There seems to be some feeling among some of the justices here that I'm attempting to create
some... You can name
some,
names.
I'm sorry?
You can name names. Go ahead.
That I'm attempting to create some difficult, impossible new standard, and that is absolutely not true. As I've pointed out in my brief, what I'm suggesting the court should adopt as the standard for the showing made by the defendant is the standard that's applied in the federal courts. The federal courts hold quite clearly that, well, they don't have the intermediate step. They don't go through the in-camera showing. You just have a showing and then you get the identity of the informer. But
What's the federal procedure? You just get an in-camera?
You don't. No, there is no in-camera in the federal system. You just, if the defendant makes a sufficient showing, he gets the identity of the informer. But to make that showing, the federal courts absolutely clearly state that the defendant has to delineate the specific testimony that she thinks the informer is going to be able to give. That's the federal test. And it is also, and this I really want to emphasize, that is also the test that this court imposed in the Green case in the very analogous situation where a defendant seeks to learn the nature of privileged medical records. Privileged medical records, privileged informer testimony. It's the same thing. You have a test that the defendant has to meet in order to get an in-camera review of privileged information. And in Green, this court made absolutely clear the defendant must set forth a fact-specific evidentiary showing describing as precisely as possible the information sought from the records, substitute informer, and how it is relevant to and supports his or her particular defense. Preliminary showing for an in-camera review requires a defendant to set forth in good faith, this is where I get the good faith from, a specific factual basis demonstrating a reasonable likelihood the records contain relevant information necessary to determination of guilt or innocence, i.e., information that will create a reasonable doubt. So we already have a standard for disclosure or for getting to an in-camera hearing, which would result in the disclosure of privileged information, we already have a standard in this state created by this court that says the defendant who seeks to have the state disclose privileged information must make a fact-specific showing, a specific factual basis. That's the same test that the federal courts apply in this very context to get the identity of the informer. You have to make a specific factual showing that the informer can give testimony that's going to create a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, I haven't looked at the federal rules currently, but federal rules were greatly discussed in the outlaw opinion. Justice Heffernan, in the lead opinion, did the legislative history, saying that in 1974, when we brought in the rules of evidence, we brought in this rule, and he said that the Judicial Council committee notes rely on the 1957 case of Roviaro, and the standard in Roviaro for an informant under the federal rules is that it is helpful to the defense, it is admissible, and it's relevant. And so that's what Heffernan adopted in the lead opinion. And Callow says, no way, I'm not going with those loosey-goosey feds. That's what he said.
That's what he said.
That's what exactly what he said. None of this helpful stuff, relevant and admissible. I want to look at the statute. This statute, 973-103B, has words that we use in Wisconsin, and this is what necessary means. It's not this loosey-goosey fed stuff. So
the point I was trying to make is that even the loosey-goosey federal courts require a fact-specific showing to get the identity of the informer, just as this court required in Green to get into medical records.
Are you saying that Roviaro isn't consistent with the first step being light indeed?
No, I'm not saying that. And again, light indeed, when I conceded in outlaw that the test was light indeed, I was talking about the standard of proof, the possibility. Mm-hmm. I wasn't suggesting, and there's nothing, if you look at my briefs, there's nothing that suggests that I was saying that that I agreed with the lead opinion and what Justice Heffernan said in terms of that's all the informer has to show, that's all the defendant has to show is that the informer can give some kind of relevant testimony.
But you, in your brief here today, say that Justice Heffernan's lead opinion with regard to the standard for the first step is the law.
Only in terms of the standard of proof,
for the
not
first step.
What must be proved.
Yeah, because the concurrence
I want to make that absolutely clear.
The concurrence,
only the standard of proof, not what must be proved.
The concurrences did not take issue at all with the lead opinion's discussion, as the Chief read earlier, about its light and its...
Yeah, but that only relates to the standard of proof, not to what must be proved. We're here today to fill in the blank in outlaw, and that is what must be shown to a possibility. Thank you. Appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrary, and thank you, Mr. Zell, for your arguments today on the informant's privilege. Of course, as you both noted, this court has dealt with that privilege previously, and I gather neither one of you is fully satisfied with the totality of those opinions. And,
may the record reflect that Mr. Balistrary was counsel on outlaw.
And it's hard to determine whether he won or lost now. Anyhow, with all due respect, with counsel's argument that maybe these prior cases are clear on the issue, We want to thank you for your briefs and your argument. And so ends the hearing on case number 2012 AP150CR, State of Wisconsin versus Jessica A. Nelson. The court will meet half hour from now in conference, and that would be 3:15. We are in recess until tomorrow.